Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Stefan, it's been a while. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Ben. It's fun to be back on.
In Cedar Falls, in our Cedar Falls studio, Scott Peters, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Scott Peters, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Stefan.
As we have in the past months, lots to digest here. We won't get to all of it. We'll try to get to as much that is at the top. And we'd like to have our listeners join in our discussion. This hour, we're going to be talking, of course, about the Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General's testimony on a couple of points yesterday, denying that he lied to Congress about the Trump's campaign ties to Russia, also pushing back against Republicans, asking that a special counsel be named to investigate Hillary Clinton, the Clinton Foundation. A little bit later in the program, we'll talk about the Roy Moore saga and what options the GOP has at this point. And what else? Oh, of course, the tax overhaul. That is what Republicans would like there to be on the plate exclusively, but all this other turmoil is there and taking up a lot of attention in the media. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. So 5 hours of congressional testimony yesterday. Let's tackle the Russia probe part of this testimony. Listen to a little bit of it. Little background here. Previously, our attorney general had denied under oath that he met with any Russians during the campaign. That denial was subsequently revealed to be false, since he had met with the Russian ambassador. He also had said that when asked whether he had any contact with Russians, quote, "I did not. I'm not aware of anyone else that did, and I don't believe it happened." But it has since been revealed that he chaired a meeting at which George Papadopoulos, this is the one who struck the plea deal just a few days ago, suggested that he could arrange a meeting between Trump and Vladimir Putin using the Russians he was in contact with. Now, according to his testimony, Sessions reportedly shut that idea down, but he had already denied any memory of that being discussed beforehand. So let's listen to a little bit of the Attorney General yesterday in his testimony.
I would like to address recent news reports regarding meetings during the campaign attended by George Papadopoulos and Carter Page, among others. Frankly, I had no recollection of this meeting until I saw these news reports. I do now recall that the March 2016 meeting at the Trump Hotel that Mr. Papadopoulos attended, but I have no clear recollection of the details of what he said at that meeting. After reading his account, and to the best of my recollection, I believe that I wanted to make clear to him that he was not authorized to represent the campaign with the Russian government or any other foreign government for that matter.
Okay, Stefan, let's start with you. What did Jeff Sessions' latest testimony on the Russia probe reveal to you?
Well, Ben, I have no recollection, actually. How many times did he say that? 30 times, I think they said. It's astonishing because if you or I, under oath, were to lie, basically to tell an untruth, there would be consequences. And it appears that once you reach a certain level in our society, there aren't really any consequences. Because he's clearly completely reversing what he said. You know, he was in the meetings. We have pictures of it. There are emails. You know, he was right there where there were efforts made to basically contact the Russians. We don't know exactly what his role was because it changes so often. And so, it's just one more thing, I think, that makes people have so little confidence in politics, politicians, and our government.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, let me push back a little bit because anybody can need a little nudge or jog of the memory in order to recall certain things. And let's face it, these people's lives are very busy.
Yeah, very busy. And the Trump campaign and then the presidency, when it finally began, was in total chaos. It was impossible to remember anything because there were so many things going on, stuff flying all over the place, people being hired and fired as fast as you could tick off the clock. And so it's understandable that he didn't remember that there were suggestions to contact Vladimir Putin, right?
Okay.
I mean, give me a break.
Okay.
Many things you might forget. I don't think you'd forget that.
Okay, Scott Peters, are you also chiming in with give me a break?
maybe a little bit. I mean, at the very least, I would say that, and this is a defense I've heard put forward, the idea that the campaign was always in total chaos, you know, these are the people who are running the government now. So that's not, you know, maybe it is a real reason why he doesn't remember the particular meeting, or didn't remember it before his memory was jogged. But it's not a very reassuring reason, exactly.
Right. I heard it, and I'm not sure who said this. Perhaps you can remember this. But we can't collude with the Russians because we can hardly collude with our own campaign.
Yeah, I've heard.
I've heard
several comments like that. Yeah, and I guess the feeling I'm left with and the sense I'm left with in all of this is, you know, the basic things we know, right? We know that the DNC was hacked and that the most likely explanation is that Russia was behind it. We know that there are a lot of people in or near the Trump campaign that had links to Russia or who were being pursued by Russians to try to develop a relationship. And, you know, you put all that together and it doesn't look good, certainly. And the administration does very little to make it look better.
Mm. Also, in the Russia probe, let's dive over quickly to the president's son, Donald Trump Jr. Monday night, The Atlantic reporting that WikiLeaks actively soliciting the president's son during the height of the 2016 general election. And here's an exchange. Donald Trump Jr. sometimes writing back to WikiLeaks. This in the article, WikiLeaks suggesting on October 3rd, 2016, "Hiya, it'd be great if you guys could comment on, push this story." And attached to that from WikiLeaks was a quote from then Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton about wanting to just drone WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Donald Trump Jr. responding in an hour and a half, "Already did that earlier today. It's amazing what she can get away with." Then on Election Day, WikiLeaks writing to Donald Trump Jr., "Hi, Don, if your father loses, we think it is much more interesting if he does not concede and spends time challenging the media and other types of rigging that occurred, as he has implied that he might do. Stefan, add this to the revelations we know," and this contact with WikiLeaks, by the way, confirmed by the president's son. What does this add to what we know about the possible collusion between Trump, the Trump campaign, and Russia?
Well, again, you know, giving the benefit of the doubt that Donald Jr. really didn't know a whole lot about WikiLeaks, didn't know that WikiLeaks has been primarily a conduit for Russian hacks that are then released and that have created some enormous nightmares for American national security, for diplomacy. You know, it may be that, honestly, Donald Trump Jr. thought WikiLeaks was a good platform that was out to pursue the truth and that there was nothing nefarious about it. But on the other hand, when you added to all of the other contacts, to the fact that the, you know, Russian involvement with social media, buying Facebook ads, having a huge number of trolls that work 24/7 to pit Americans against each other. Now the revelation. I mean, I have a student in the UK who is doing a research project, and now all of a sudden the breaking news is that Brexit may have succeeded because the Russians were basically manipulating social media against remaining in the European Union. So this is a giant story. We can do every week, we can do a radio show and talk about this because it is unfolding. The latest, of course, is that the National Security Agency was compromised, may still be compromised, that their tools for hacking and for surveillance have now been put on the black market, on the internet, on the dark net. So this is a not only disturbing but really frightening thing. And Donald Trump Jr. is just a little piece of something much, much bigger.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the part of the Jeff Sessions testimony that raised the possibility, he did, that I think this was in a letter before this testimony, the night before, that a special counsel may be appointed to investigate potential wrongdoing by the Clinton Foundation, specifically suggestions that a U.S. government panel approve the sale of a large uranium firm to Russian interests, this in exchange for donations to the Clinton Foundation, the so-called Uranium One deal. It's been the focus of conservative media. And Donald Trump also, he's repeatedly asked via Twitter why the Department of Justice is not actively investigating this matter. Well, yesterday in the Sessions testimony, Representative Jim Jordan told Attorney General Jeff Sessions it looks like there's enough evidence to appoint a special counsel to investigate Hillary Clinton.
We know one fact. We know the Clinton campaign, the Democrat National Committee paid for, through the law firm, paid for the dossier. We know that happened. And it sure looks like the FBI was paying the author of that document. And it sure looks like a major political party was working with the federal government to then turn an opposition research document, the equivalent of some National Enquirer story, into an intelligence document, take that to the FISA court so that they could then get a warrant to spy on Americans associated with President Trump's campaign. That's what it looks like. And I'm asking you, doesn't that warrant, in addition to all the things we know about James Comey in 2016, doesn't that warrant naming a second special counsel, as 20 members of this committee wrote you 3.5 months ago asking you to do?
Well, Mr. Comey is no longer the director of the FBI.
Thank goodness.
We have an excellent man of integrity and ability in Chris Wray, and I think he's going to do an outstanding job, and I'm very happy
about
that.
He's not here
today,
Attorney General. I would say
looks like is not enough basis to appoint a special counsel.
Okay, there were the words we heard on many news cuts. Looks like is not enough to support a special counsel. Scott Peters, comment on this exchange, and what do you think of this now being raised possibility of a second special counsel, this one to investigate Clinton?
Well, I guess so far to me, all the allegations about that, such as you heard the congressman laying out there, are a lot of disconnected things that aren't illegal. Also, a lot of really partial, incomplete representations of what we know. For example, he talked a lot about the dossier on Trump, which actually originated as opposition research by other Republicans, and then the Democrats kind of swooped in and paid for it, opposition research to continue. It's not illegal to do opposition research. There's absolutely nothing illegal about that. Whereas by comparison, the independent counsel investigating the Russia connections with the Trump campaign begins with a very clear illegal activity, the hacking of a computer system and the publication of private emails. Mm-hmm. Right off the bat, you've got a much different situation. Certainly, the career prosecutors in the Justice Department, if they get wind that things are that illegalities may have been done, they are well within their powers to investigate these things. The reason we tend to appoint special prosecutors or independent prosecutors is when, in some reason, there's reason to believe that there would be some kind of conflict of interest, or that otherwise the leadership in the Justice Department would not be able to conduct an impartial investigation.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, jump in here. A second special counsel, do you see that coming?
Well, the big problem with it really is that even Republicans are saying you really don't want to relitigate history. You do not want to go back to the previous administration and try to sue people. We're moving forward. And the reason you don't want to do it is because when the Trump administration is over, and it'll be over at some point, they are not going to want to have things that happened during the Trump administration relitigated then by a special prosecutor. You kind of say, you know, this is history. Let's move forward. The other thing is with the Uranium One, I highly recommend that people look at Shepard Smith and look at his Fox report on debunking Uranium One, because I think he's going to be fired, frankly, from Fox, because he's undermining the entire narrative that this was illegal, it was a conspiracy, and so on. He goes through in great detail why this was clean and done long before contributions were made to the Clinton Foundation. Hillary Clinton wasn't even Secretary of State at that point yet, and that this panel unanimously said, yes, it's fine to sell this because the uranium was going to remain in the United States and it was going to go primarily to private manufacturers and others in the United States. None of it was going to go to Russia. None of it was going to be exported. And so I think the Republicans probably don't want to continue to go after this Uranium One thing, because one of the reliable conservative commentators and analysts and reporters at Fox has completely debunked the story. And so it's not a good place to go politically and certainly not legally.
Mm-hmm. Comment on this aspect. A criticism of the Uranium One deal has circulated for weeks within conservative media circles, as we've just spoken about. Now, also, the president has brought attention to it by calling on the Justice Department to launch an investigation into the issue. Scott, how unusual is it for a president to call on his Justice Department to investigate a specific issue or a specific person?
That is unusual, for sure. The president, the Justice Department is in a tricky situation because it at once administers federal programs, and so there are aspects of the Justice Department and the Attorney General's jobs that are comparable to any political appointee, you know, the agriculture secretary or what have you, right, where they are carrying out federal programs. But there's another aspect of the Attorney General's job that demands that the Attorney General have some level of independence from the president, and in fact demands that prosecutors underneath the Attorney General have a little bit of independence from the Attorney General. And that is the notion that when investigating and potentially prosecuting federal crimes and wrongdoings, those investigations need to be based upon the merits and as impartially as possible, an assessment of the merits of the case, mm-hmm. not based on political motivations. And so to the extent that the president appears to be encouraging the prosecution of political rivals, it's extremely problematic. As with so many things, it is, President Trump is busting down norms in our democracy. A lot of people who are concerned about the rule of law and basic norms of democracy are watching right. These things very closely.
Right. Stefan, whether Republican or Democratic administrations in the past have always steered clear of creating the appearance of political influence on the Justice Department, right? This president doesn't worry about it at all.
Well, you kind of try to stay clear of it, but I think, you know, most presidents would like somewhere maybe at the airport in Las Vegas to influence the Justice Department by slipping into the Attorney General's airplane and talking to her a little bit about maybe not prosecuting Hillary Clinton. So,
right.
Yeah, you don't remember that, but I do.
I do, in fact, remember that, of course.
You know,
yes.
You always want to do it, and it cost Bill Clinton a lot, and the Republicans really used it against Hillary Clinton, you know, that Bill Clinton was trying to really influence the Attorney General, whether he was doing that or not, because he said, I wasn't doing that. I was just talking to her about my children, my grandchild, and, you know, it was just we're friends, so I was just talking to her. Well, maybe. But the point is that if Donald Trump were to get on an airplane with the Attorney General and, you know, whisper something, it would be suspicious. But you don't want to politicize the Justice Department, because when you look around the world, look at the news coming out of Zimbabwe and other places. The one thing that keeps our country, I think, stable and democratic is that our courts and our justice system has tended to be as apolitical as is possible, fair, and is the arbiter, is the referee of everything that we do. If we contaminate that and use the Justice Department, remember Richard Nixon tried to do that, and he got punished for it, and he had to actually resign as president because during Watergate he was definitely trying to influence the Justice Department, fire the special prosecutor. He did fire the special prosecutor. So we want to make sure that we don't allow leaders to do that. And I think maybe, hopefully, the Republicans are going to talk to President Trump and say, really, you don't want to go there. You just don't want to do that, because we don't want the Democrats doing that to us when they're in power. And let's keep the Justice Department as, you know, the impartial rule enforcer. So I think it's dangerous to do that.
Let's bite into the next apple quickly. Perhaps we'll have to finish up after the break. The tax plan. Yesterday, Republican senators announcing changes to their proposals to rewrite the U.S. tax code. The big news, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, so-called insurance mandate, saving hundreds of billions of dollars over a decade. It's one of the most unpopular parts of Obamacare. Scott, let me throw it to you. What do you make of this this insert here, the repeal of the ACA's mandate surfacing now?
It seems that the reason it's surfaced again is that the Republicans are looking for money. They need to keep the total cost of their tax cuts to $1.5 trillion over 10 years. And they're currently way more expensive than that. And so that's one of the reasons they're getting rid of deductions, various deductions in the tax code, to try to raise more revenue to get it under that $1.5 trillion mark. And if you get rid of the individual mandate, that means fewer people will buy insurance, which means that the government will have to pay out fewer subsidies for people who buy that insurance. And that frees up money to give in the form of tax cuts. Honestly, though, I don't know if it makes it any easier to pass this through the Senate. There's a number of different procedural issues in the Senate that make it tough to get to 51 votes, even aside from the policy differences, which in and of themselves make it tough to get to 51 votes.
Stefan, we have to go to break. I can give you 20 or 30 seconds on this. This is being sold as a middle-class tax cut. Is it in the House or the Senate?
Some people say it isn't. I'm not an accountant. I'm not an economist. But the other thing is, here what they're trying to do is to join together the two most difficult things, health care and tax reform, and you wonder how that's going to turn out.
Okay, Stefan Schmidt is with us of Iowa State University. Our other political analyst this week, Scott Peters of the University of Northern Iowa. Stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back. We'll talk about the saga of sexual assault allegations surrounding Alabama GOP Senate candidate Roy Moore. And we'll ask our guests, what are the GOP's options here at this point, just days away from the election? I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the program, you'll want to tune in. We'll look back at the Russian Revolution. It's 100th anniversary, and looking at the Russian Revolution and how Russia, the Soviet Union, moved through the 20th century, changed to the point where they are to now, now in the world. That tomorrow on our program. Today, Politics Wednesday, picking through the latest on the political landscape. There is plenty. And we are talking with Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Also, Scott Peters of the University of Northern Iowa, where he's Associate Professor of Political Science. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Gentlemen, let's talk about the Roy Moore saga, the predicament it has put the GOP in. On Monday, another Alabama woman accused Roy Moore, the state's Republican nominee for U.S. Senate, of sexual assault, alleging that he attacked her behind the restaurant where she worked when she was 16. He was something like 30 years old. Beverly Young Nelson is the fifth woman to accuse Moore of making romantic or sexual advances toward them when they were teenagers. She is the first to allege assault. Let's listen to a little bit of this gripping testimony. Even though we're not playing some of the most graphic details of her account, this may be disturbing to some listeners.
I tried fighting him off while yelling at him to stop. But instead of stopping, he began squeezing my neck, attempting to force my head onto his crotch. I continued to struggle. I was determined that I was not going to allow him to force me to have sex with him. I was terrified. He was also trying to pull my shirt off. I thought that he was going to rape me. I was twisting and I was struggling and I was begging him to stop. I had tears running down my face. At some point he gave up. And he then looked at me and he told me, he said, "You're just a child." And he said, "I am the district attorney of Etowah County. And if you tell anyone about this, no one will ever believe you."
Beverly Young Nelson testifying, or before the media, I should say, on Monday. Now, of course, many Republicans in the meantime coming out saying they believe the allegations and that Roy Moore should withdraw from the race. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, one of those. Yesterday evening at the Wall Street Journal CEO Council's annual meeting in Washington, McConnell floated Attorney General Jeff Sessions as a replacement for Moore. He cited Senator Lisa Murkowski, the Republican from Alaska, as a successful example of a write-in campaign.
The name being most often discussed may not be available, but the Alabamian who would, you know, fit that standard would be the Attorney General, right, who's totally well known and extremely popular in Alabama. That obviously is, would be a big move for him and for the president. But president is winding his way back to the United States, I'm confident this is an issue they're discussing in great detail.
So is Jeff Sessions a possibility?
We don't know. But he fits the mold of somebody who might be able to pull off a write-in.
Right.
And in the same way that Lisa was able to do it in 2010.
You say that like somebody who would like to see that happen.
I'd like to save the seat. And it's a heck of a dilemma when you've got a completely unacceptable candidate bearing the label of your party within a month of the election.
Okay, let's hear from Roy Moore himself, the embattled GOP candidate for U.S. Senate, speaking to would-be supporters yesterday. This was his first major public appearance since the five women came forward with accusations against him. Here's a snippet of it.
I'm playing a little part in this scenario going on in the country. Obviously, I've made a few people mad. I'm the only one that can unite Democrats and Republicans. Because I seem to be opposed by both. They've spent over $30 million to try to take me out. Why do you think I'm being harassed by media and by people pushing for allegations in the last 28 days of this election? Last 30 days it began. After 40-something years of fighting this battle, I'm now facing allegations, and that's all the press want to talk about. But I want to talk about the issues. I want to talk about where this country's going, and if we don't come back to God, we're not going anywhere.
Okay, there you have it, the accused, the accuser, and Mitch McConnell, majority leader in a sticky situation. Stefan, comment after we've heard those three perspectives.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating story, and I think, first of all, the latest news is probably the most damaging, and that is the news from the shopping mall in Gadsden, Alabama, which is his hometown there. Five lawyers, two police officers, and a bunch of mall employees, and several people who, quote, hung around the mall in those days, remembering that he was banned from the mall. Now, how many people are banned from the mall that is near our listeners, wherever they are here in Iowa or in neighboring states? You know, that's pretty rare, and usually people who are banned from the mall are, you know, misbehaving in a serious way. So that's serious. To Mitch McConnell, I would say, dream on, because Judge Moore is loved by a hardcore of constituents who love him, trust him. He is not going to pull out. And if you try to run anyone against him, Mitch McConnell, who, you know, thinks that maybe Sessions would do the job, it'll just split the vote, because he's on the ballot. Moore is on the ballot. People will go vote. Some may have already voted. I'm not sure what the voting law there is, how early you can vote. And it'll split it, and you'll have some voting for Moore and some voting for Jeff Sessions. And it'll tank, the Republican candidate, and the Democrat is likely to win. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who say nobody wants to run against Moore, and, you know, he'll win the election. And then the Republicans are stuck with their next issue, which is, do they seat him? Do they basically expel him from the Senate or not if he wins? It's a mess. It's a real mess. Right. The governor actually could still change the date of the election, because she has the power to do that.
Well, what would that look like, though?
Well, yeah, that's right. It would not look very good. So, you know, this is one of those tragic, interesting, fascinating, complex stories that is distracting us from the fact that we have all kinds of enormous issues that we need to resolve, and we're once again getting essentially sidelined on something that is really attractive from the media point of view, because it's a shiny object. Right. But, you know, health reform, tax reform, North Korea, trade, and some of those things get sidelined because of these things.
Okay, yeah. Also historic. That's why it's a very shiny object. The last time a senator, look this up, a senator was expelled, 1862, when several senators back then pledged allegiance to the Confederacy. Let's go to our phones.
Oh, interesting.
Carolyn in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Carolyn. We've got a lot of people on the line. Please make it quick, but
welcome to our program. Thank you. I don't want us to get sidelined by what's happening in Alabama by having us overlook what's happening in the Iowa legislature with the Senate Majority Leader, Bill Dix, trying to take the report that was conducted on sexual harassment in the Iowa State House and not allowing transparency to the taxpayers who are responsible for paying the lawsuit. And I support the young woman who brought that suit forward and the courage it took for her to do that and the price she's paid for it, although I don't disagree with the lawsuit settlement. But for Senator Dix to now say that Iowans don't have the right to know about the process and the outcome of that investigation, it just raises more questions to me about the depth of what's going on in the Iowa State House.
Interesting. Thank you, Carolyn. Just as a footnote there, of course, our own Joyce Russell reporting on the story that Carolyn is mentioning there. On Friday on our News Buzz edition, I'll be talking about that with Joyce Russell about what's sexual harassment is everywhere now, pervading Hollywood, certainly Washington, and our own a topic at our own Iowa legislature. Tim of Iowa City writing, in the case of the former Iowa Senate GOP staffer Kirsten Anderson, who was offered $2.2 million in a settlement for a sexual harassment case, why do we taxpayers have to fit the bill for that settlement? Why doesn't the Republican Party of Iowa pay for that, since everyone involved was Republican? Okay, just a couple of comments there. Let's, Scott, we haven't heard from you a little bit. To talk about what you see as options the Republicans have now in dealing with Roy Moore.
Sure. I think, as you heard from Senator McConnell there, the hope of the Republican leadership right now is that they can in some way pressure Moore to withdraw. If they can't do that, that they could get someone to run it, to mount a write-in campaign, which would be a pretty daunting endeavor with only 2 or 3 weeks here till the election. Even if he withdraws, believe it or not, he could still win the election. I mean, the ballots are printed, right? So they're out there. He could still technically win the election, which I believe would mean that then the governor would get to appoint yet another interim person until you could hold another special election.
Scott and Stefan, correct me if I'm wrong, but the president has not really shown his cards on whether he still backs Roy Moore or whether he believes Moore's accusers and not Moore's denials, as Jeff Sessions and Mitch McConnell have, saying that they do believe the accusers. Yeah, Stefan.
You know, let me just say that Donald Trump never supported him. Remember, he wanted really to get someone else to win the primary and be the candidate, Mr. Strange. And
all the more reason that he should be speaking out against him as the candidate, right?
Donald Trump, you know, zigzags a lot. And I think, you know, he probably is pretty distracted from his long trip to Asia. He's probably recovering from that and getting advice on how to deal with this. But, you know, the biggest player in all of this, of course, is Steve Bannon, who wanted Moore to be the candidate, who is the disruptor who wants to bust up the traditional establishment Republican Party, hates Mitch McConnell, thinks Mitch McConnell should resign. And I think we have to remember that going forward, this is going to be the big story for the Republicans. They have essentially an outside sniper who is going after their candidates, their positions on issues, from, you know, the media point of view, and he's got a bunch of very big donors who give to Breitbart and to his agenda. And so this is another manifestation of that interference in the traditional Republican Party's effort to essentially, you know, be a mainstream party and not go too far off, you know, off the map.
And the Republican Party's been through this very recently. You might remember back in the 2010 election, they nominated a whole bunch of, on the Senate side in particular, a whole bunch of very far-right candidates. You know, some of them won, but quite a few of them lost what would have been winnable seats against vulnerable Democrats in that election that went so handily against the Democrats. And, you know, that may have cost them control of the Senate at that time. So the Republicans have done this before. They've done this to themselves before, relatively recently. And, you know, certainly the mainstream Republicans, people like McConnell, think that if Bannon has his way, that's going to happen again.
Let me
just say one more quick thing, just a little. Ben, you mentioned that the last senator to be removed, expelled from the Senate was back around the Civil War. But there is a more recent example who resigned rather than be expelled, and that was Bob Packwood back in the 1990s over similar kinds of situation, over allegations of sexual harassment.
Right.
So the Senate has some experience there as well.
And Scott, I just wanted to make sure that you clarify for our listeners that Senate candidates and House candidates are not selected by or often even the preferred candidates of the Republican Party itself. It's the state primaries that produce those candidates, and often the national party has almost no control over it. So, you know, when someone gets selected as a candidate who says, I am not a witch, which was one of the candidates that you're referring to, it was not the National Republican Party that wanted her to become a candidate or to win. It was, you know, voters in the states that go and support a certain candidate. So this is the strange thing about American politics that's different from other countries. You know, our national party doesn't play much of a role in the selection of candidates.
About 5 minutes left. I wanted to get your comments on the Senate committee holding the first congressional hearings yesterday, first ones in more than four decades, on the president's authority to launch a nuclear strike. And, of course, it comes amid concern that tensions over North Korea's weapons program could lead to war. Senator Bob Corker, Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, held this hearing, acknowledging that senators, including Democrats and Trump's fellow Republicans, have raised questions about the president's authority to wage war, use nuclear weapons, to enter or end international agreements. Let's hear one little section from that testimony, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Here's an opinion voiced at the end of the hearing from Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat, arguing that the check and balance currently in place on the president's authority to declare nuclear war is not enough.
I don't think that we should be trusting the generals to be a check on the president. I don't think we should be trusting a set of protocols to be protecting the American people from having a nuclear war launched on their behalf. I don't think we should be relying upon a group of individuals to be resisting an illegal order when they have all pretty much been hired by the president to have the jobs in which they have. There's going to be a homogeneity inside of that decision-making process, Mr. Chairman, that does not, in fact, offer real resistance if the president absolutely insists upon his way. That's just the reality of it. So I agree with Mr. McKeon that it should be the congressional prerogative to declare a nuclear war.
Okay. Is there a lot of gray area here, Stefan Schmidt? Do we need this discussion to happen?
Yeah, we need the discussion to happen because the protocols that are in place right now are from the Cold War, in which the moment was that you cannot have lengthy debates in Congress over whether or not to use nuclear weapons, because then it wouldn't be a credible deterrent against the first strike by the Soviet Union against the U.S. It had to be that if the Russians do anything, the president can immediately launch a second strike or retaliatory strike. We're not in the Cold War anymore, but, you know, certainly North Korea is a big threat.
And
so the rules are a little bit old.
Right, right. Stefan, correct me if I'm wrong. Scott, perhaps you know this. The U.S. retains the right to a first strike. It has renounced the first, not renounced the first strike.
I know. I guess I don't know about as a matter of sort of, you know,
as a principle that.
Yeah,
that,
I mean, certainly the. The Trump administration has periodically alluded to using all of the U.S.'s capabilities, and I believe that perhaps it was the Secretary of Defense recently did make some statement that indicated that a first strike might be a possibility. I would just say that in terms of these hearings, they are overdue, and it's part of a larger issue, really, frankly, where Congress over the last several decades has really not done its job on really basic things. I mean, we're still operating as we're fighting ISIS around the globe now. We're still operating on the authorization for the use of military force that was passed in 2001 to fight al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Congress just quite simply has not done its job on these basic elements of governance. It has given too much deference to presidents, and that's presidents of both parties. And it has not done its job as the body that the people of the United States elect to govern us.
Mm-hmm. And Bob Corker made it clear also in that hearing that this was not intended to target President Trump specifically. He said this is not specific to anybody. So it sounds like, a good discussion to have had. Quickly before we go, President Trump back from Asia last night, returning 12 days in Asia. Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, China, the Philippines. Stefan, what did we learn? What are the takeaways? What did the president point to as successes? What were the successes?
Well, you know, some of it was pomp and circumstance, and certainly the president got along marvelously with some authoritarian leaders, China and certainly the Philippines. If he got a trade agreement and has massive investments from China. We'll have to see if that pans out. He did get the three American basketball players released, which will score on the plus side. He also did some strange things and kind of went off track a little bit. On the whole, I think the trip will be forgotten pretty soon, but it was spectacular.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Nothing moved in terms of our standoff with North Korea over its nuclear ambitions.
No, but we have three aircraft carrier groups that are, you know, maneuvering right off the shore of Korea. And hopefully that at least will tell North Korea, you know, maybe it is time to make friends with Donald Trump, since he wants to make friends with Rocket Man. So Maybe that was the nicest thing to come out of it, is that he says he thinks he can make friends with Kim Jong-un.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Nobody believes it, but, you know, it was nice.
All right. We didn't get to everything on the list. Of course, the list is very long these days. Stefan Schmidt, good to have you back. University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Scott Peters stepping into our Cedar Falls studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your analysis. We appreciate it. We'll hope to have you back soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben, and nice talking with you as well, Scott.
Likewise.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also in Ames from Alex Hansen. In Cedar Falls, Chris Fenton. Thanks for your help. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, as I mentioned, a look back at the Russian Revolution, the 100th anniversary of it. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.